To the 14th episode of the Think Wildlife podcast. Today we have Vidya Venkatesh, who is the founder of the Last Wilderness Foundation.
So welcome, Vidya.
Hi, Anish. Thank you for having me over at your podcast. As you already mentioned, I'm Vidya Venkatesh, and I'm the director for Last Wilderness Foundation. The organization is about a decade plus old, about 12, 13 years old. So I've been with the firm, or with this organization, for almost about 11, 12 years now.
So you did a BCom with a focus on accounts and worked in a couple of MNCs. But what motivated you to take a career shift into the conservation sector?
So very interestingly, you know, during my college days, that was when I attended one of the WWF camps, which actually drew me towards nature and wildlife. That 3-day camp is actually what fascinated me, and then there was no looking back. I've always been passionate about nature and wildlife. So through my corporate career from 98 onwards, since I started my corporate jobs, all my holidays, all my vacations and weekends have always been into the forest or into the mountains. So that's my passion. And I pursued the hobby for almost about 13, 14 years of my corporate career, assuming that that might fade off at some point of time, or, you know, thinking that it's just another hobby like everybody has. But this didn't go off. So by the towards the 12th, 13th, 14th year, you know, I started thinking very seriously about how do I, you know, get this more and more into my life, and how do I, you know, shift or make the shift into wildlife conservation. Actually, it wasn't wildlife conservation back then. I just knew that I wanted to be in wildlife. So my shift was a little bit of a transition phase that I had about a couple of years. So initially, when I quit my corporate life, I started looking for opportunities, or I started looking for avenues where I could spend more and more time into the wilderness. So apart from traveling into the wilderness, we also, a couple of our friends, we had started a firm, a travel firm, where we used to conduct group tours and take tourists into the park. So that also gave me a great insight into the different parks of India, Northeast, North India, birding tours, herb tours. So all of it we've done in those couple of years. But then that also wasn't something that really satisfied me, because I wanted to do something more on ground. That is when I started looking for opportunities in conservation. And I joined Sanctuary Asia for a year. Around 2010 to 11, I was with Sanctuary Asia. I led the Kids for Tigers initiative. And in 2011 is when I joined Last Wilderness Foundation. So since then, there was no looking back.
How difficult was this transition from MNC to the conservation sector?
So honestly, I think I've been lucky that I wouldn't say it was difficult. Yes, it needed a lot of planning. So I did do a lot of planning. Being from a financial background, you know, finance planning was very, very key to what I was doing, because moving from my MNC sector to an NGO sector or into the field of wildlife is not going to be as lucrative as an MNC, definitely. So I had to have my backup plans. I had to have sustainability for a few months or maybe a year. I had to keep finances in place. So that was one big planning that I had to do. Apart from that, of course, I had to have a fallback just in case I wouldn't survive, or I was not able to sustain in this sector. Then I always probably had to fall back on the MNC sector. So that was the other planning that I had to keep in mind, saying, you know, finances and career. These two, I did think of a backup plan. But pretty much, you know, like I said, I've been lucky that I got a breakthrough with Last Wilderness, and it was exactly what I wanted to do. So when I met the founder director, Nikhil Nangle, I think it was pretty much like a calling, saying that, yes, this is exactly what I wanted to do. When he explained the job role to me, I was very, very interested, and there was no second thought about it. So yeah, it just came to me without too much of a difficulty, I would say.
How have your experiences with the MNC sectors you in your conservation career?
So there's a lot of parallels that I draw from the MNC sector here, just that this sector probably does not have as many, or this, when I say this sector, the NGO sector probably does not have as many people who are experienced from a project management perspective, a people management perspective, or for that matter, problem solving skills. So in the corporate sector, we had a whole lot of skill honing mechanisms in terms of either a mentor or a training, a plan put in place. So we were all trained to do certain roles as managers. So through our career in the corporate life, we were trained for different roles. And all of it, from problem solving to negotiation skills, to people management skills, to team building skills, to project management, deliverables, quality deliverables, all of it is something that I even today use in my day-to-day life, because without that, I don't think it would have been easy for me to get this far in this journey.
Coming to the last Wilderness Foundation, which areas do you guys mostly work with?
So our work is primarily in the field of human-wildlife conflict mitigation, Anish. But when we say human-wildlife conflict mitigation, there are many aspects to this particular domain as well. And LWF focuses on the community angle. So we partner with the forest departments. Specifically, we've been working in Madhya Pradesh. So we partner with the forest department very closely to understand the conflict areas, the conflict situations. Geographical, also understanding where and why the conflicts are happening, and then work with the communities accordingly, because that is one area where the forest department always needs help to manage the local communities. That's slightly not into their forte. Habitat management, wildlife management, all of it is being trained. They are trained on all of it, but handling local people and working with communities is something which usually the forest department finds it quite difficult, and they would like to take help of NGOs to work in that domain. So we work in the domain of trying to work with communities and reduce the human wildlife conflict situations around tiger reserves.
Recently, the world celebrated a 40% increase in global tiger populations. India managed to double the population from 2010 in 2018. While this is certainly good news, this does have a lot of implications for human tiger conflict. What have you been observing with trends in tiger human conflict in the last few years?
So, Anish, the fact that the numbers have increased is a great, fact, I would say. It's a great news. It's a great fact. But like you already mentioned, the challenge also comes along with it, right? So the challenges are with the given limited space that we have and with the increasing number of population in India, there is always going to be this human-wildlife conflict that will exist. The only way out is coexistence. India has had a great history in trying to preserve and conserve its natural heritage, including the species. We've probably been one of the pioneer countries who's managed to preserve maximum number of species, within the country, though we've had some species that we've lost. But having said that, our religions, our beliefs have helped a long way in terms of coexisting with animals. And the thought processes that people have at large is of protection and preservation than destroying and killing. So that's, helped us in a long way. So coexistence is the only mantra that we should be working with, and that's the only way we could survive. So ever increasing number of tigers may not be useful for India because we also have an ever increasing population of humans. So with that, ever-increasing population of tigers may not be very helpful. But of course, we do have spaces even now where the forests are conducive for tigers, the habitats are conducive for tigers, and we still don't have tigers there. So there is a long way to go before we can say we are at saturation point. And I don't have a number right now to say how many tigers can India accommodate. But at the same time, there will be a limit when we say, okay, this is all that we can, have in our country. That is going to be a situation.
My next question for you is, what are some ecological factors other than tiger population increase which contributes to human-wildlife conflict?
So the ecological factors majorly, of course, development is one of the biggest factors, Anish. The linear developments that we've been having in our country, that has actually put a lot of things at stake. And though we are trying to put mitigation measures in place, it's still not going to be the same. But having said that, with the population of what we have in our country, it's not going to be easy to stop the development as well. So we need to strike a balance between development and trying to conserve and preserve our natural heritage and wildlife so that, we also have convenient facilities for people living in this country, as well as trying to keep the population safe. So ecological factors, coming back to the point, you know, development is one of the biggest threats that we have. Apart from the fact that, you know, the reduction in the areas of forests or protected areas. So the population growth, I would say, which is actually the demand where the forests are being cut down and the developments are being, you know, are taking place, is one of the major threats that I would say, apart from a lot of other climate change threats that we have. But population is the common factor that I would say across all of these threats.
India has about 300 million people living in and around forests. So how has human wildlife conflict impacted the opinion of these communities towards conservation?
So I think, like I mentioned, most of the people, if you ask them around the tiger reserves, you know, so there are tribal and non-tribal communities living around tiger reserves. Most of the people, if you ask them their views about wildlife, they're just going to say that, yeah, I mean, they've always been there. You know, it's like asking anybody from the city saying, what do you think about cars around you? You know, and you're going to say, yeah, I mean, I've always lived with cars around me, right? So they've always lived with wildlife around them. So it's not like they would hate wildlife or they're not going to like wildlife around them. But when there is an economic loss to any individual or a family, that's when there is a situation that arises. And, you know, that situation is usually not so much of a just an economic loss. Of course, it is an economic loss, but it's also a lot to do with some local political issues that arise around these conflict issues. So there could be a political leader in the village or in the vicinity who would, you know, encourage the villager to say, oh, you have to fight for your rights. Oh, you have to do this. So the person who actually has undergone a loss may or may not be necessarily in a situation where he hates wildlife or he has a conflict with wildlife just because there has been a death or just because his cattle has been taken away or just because his crop has been raided by a you know, herbivore. He's not going to have vengeance or revenge that he would want to take. But sometimes there are people around him who arouse these situations. And that is also the troublemaker in a village or in a vicinity area, which is what we like to tackle or we try to tackle most of the times when there is human wildlife conflict situation. But otherwise, at large, I would say in India, people living around protected areas, around tiger reserves, are not against wildlife. They would love wildlife. They revere in many of the places, in many of the villages in central India also, they revere the animal, the large cat, which is a tiger, and they call it Baghesur. So people worship the animal, even though they sometimes incur losses, but they still think that it's a sacrifice to the god and they you know, don't feel revengeful about it. Very, very rare situations where there has been a revenge killing, where people sometimes poison the carcass of a cattle or sometimes light a fire in the forest. But those are really rare situations when the conflict has been building up over a period of time. It's not a one-off instance, but that one instance would probably have triggered an action. That is when this whole conflict situation arises. Our work or the suggestion would be to have a continuous dialogue with people around these protected areas. So it's a huge onus on the forest department and the local authorities to have continuous dialogues with the local communities so that these situations are actually nipped in the bud itself and they don't accumulate to burst out into a massive conflict situation.
Government does pay a lot of compensation to the victims of human wildlife conflict. However, this has not been so successful. Could you just talk about some of the challenges to this compensation scheme?
So in Central India that I can talk about, Anish, the scheme I think has been quite successful. I don't think it's an unsuccessful scheme. I think it's pretty successful to the extent that, you know, if it's a cattle which has been injured, the treatment for the cattle is paid by the government. If there is a cattle which has been killed by the carnivore or a big cat, then that is also being compensated. A human life death is also compensated. So all of these compensations are already existing. However, the issue is not with the scheme not being successful. The issue is with sometimes the middlemen where the schemes are not reaching the ground villages. However, MP has done a brilliant job of having a system called as Lok Seva Kendra, where it's a public redressal forum, a grievance forum, where people can actually log in their complaints and they can track their complaints even through a phone call to understand where and how the progress has been about their complaint. And there is a feedback mechanism and there's an escalation mechanism for every complaint, including compensation grievance that has been logged in there. So I think MP has done a fantastic job in terms of Lok Seva Kendra being present out there. So the scheme has been pretty successful even in the remote parts of the country.
That's great. And talking about solutions towards human wildlife conflict, so you guys work with a lot of local communities for a lot of awareness programs. One of your key projects is the Village Kids Awareness Program. I think it's mostly in Bandhavgarh. So could you just talk about this project and why you're targeting local children for outreach events?
So, as per the of course, LWF's vision also says that, we would love to have a natural heritage in India respected and protected by its people. So the ultimate protectors are going to be the local people in any protected area or a protected forest. And without the support of local people, the forest can either be protected or destroyed by them, right? So the idea is to get a positive buy-in from them or to get a buy-in from the locals to ensure that they themselves understand the importance of protecting the forest instead of trying to be the police all the time and trying to punish the people locally. Instead of that, if we are able to get the locals on our positive side of conservation, then there are so many more hands and legs and eyes that are available for protecting a forest. Now, how do you create that positivity or how do you create that kind of a manpower amongst the locals? Obviously, you want to understand and you want to let them admire the forest like the way you and me do, because you and me have been looking at the forest as a tourist and we admire the forest because the forest has never done any wrong or any loss, has never incurred any loss to us. But the people living there have incurred losses. At the same time, it is important for them to also understand the positive side as to why should they protect the forest from a holistic perspective, saying what is the impact on climate change, on global warming, on their lives, more importantly, on a day-to-day basis, why should they protect the forest? If they're able to understand these small concepts, then they will definitely be on the positive side of conservation. And to make them understand this, I think there needs to be a large outreach and awareness program in our country where the locals are involved and the concepts are clarified and they understand the importance. Instead of just looking at the negative side, they would understand how it is helping the entire country and of course in their day-to-day lives as well, if they're able to protect the forest. So this small concept that we're talking about usually is packaged in a capsule form and spoken to with the village kids, because they are the ones who are unbiased, who do not have any blockages in their head saying, oh, this is how I want to lead my life. They're open to ideas, they're open to suggestions, and they can be easily molded. So the kids are one of the best audience that you can actually work with. And when they grow, you at least know that generation onwards, you have a good, local population who can protect the forest going forward.
That's great. And a lot of your outreach programs have been targeted at the Parati community. So can you just talk about some of these programs, especially your nature guide training program?
So the Pardi community has been very special for us and one of our key projects that we've been working in the last decade. So the Pardis are a community who used to be erstwhile hunters, Anish. And they were actually blamed for the extinction of tigers in Panna. And that's how they came to limelight. They've always been hunting large mammals and birds. But because the extinction of the tigers happened in Panna, that's how they came into the limelight. Since then, the forest department, the education department, the local authorities have all been trying to work with this community to ensure that, it doesn't happen again, the dilemma doesn't happen again. At the same time, MP Forest Department also planned to reintroduce tigers into Panna in 2009. So actually in 2007 onwards. So when they really started working on the reintroduction program, they realized that without working with the Pardis, it's going to be impossible task to bring in tigers and make it a successful project. So in order to make the tiger introduction a successful project, they started working with the Pardis And that's when we stepped in. Initially, WWF used to work with this project. When WWF stopped their project and there was no other NGO working there, LWF had stepped in. And since then, about 2012 onwards, we've been working with the community almost a decade now. And we're trying to help the community to get away from the stigma of being poachers, from the stigma of being, you know, a tribe which has always been into criminal activities. So we're educating the kids. The government is also supporting a lot. The Forest Department is supporting a lot in educating their kids, in providing alternate livelihoods, and in also providing them stability to their stay, their you know, home facilities, etc. It's a slow process. It's a very slow process, but with some consistency that, you know, we've managed to get in the program, there has been some results. In fact, there are a few kids who've graduated last year and this year. Similarly, the guide training program. So our idea was to harness the skills that they have from the forest. So they've been nomads and they've lived in the forest all their life. So trying to understand what skills they have, and if we could use their skills for their own benefit and in a good way, you know, then they could probably earn a living out of it. So their understanding of the forest was so good that we, you know, had to bring in a component where they could earn out of this knowledge. And Nature Guide was a good source of income for them, because Panna, being a tiger reserve, it already had a footfall of tourists coming in. Apart from the tiger safaris that people take, nowadays people love to go with the pardis. They love to listen to the stories that the pardis have to say about the forest. And, you know, they have some beautiful skills of mimicking animals like the sloth bear, the tigers, some birds. So they mimic bird calls, they mimic mammal calls. And with that help, that is how they used to hunt. That's how they know the calls. But with that, they also, you know, share the knowledge with the tourists these days. And that has been a great source of revenue, you know, for the Pardi community. So we've just been trying to help them with the traditional skill sets that they have.
Okay. So you guys also work extensively with the Forest Department in capacity building, particularly with the forest staff. So how have your experiences been working with these forest staff?
So working with the forest staff has been, you know, another experience, Anish. I think hats off to the ground staff, really hats off to the way they work with such limited facilities that are given to them. The expectation from the ground staff is the maximum, whereas the facilities given to them is a minimum. The forest guards and the staff who live inside the forest, they're expected to do foot patrolling day in and day out. So night and day, they're supposed to do foot patrolling, Anish. However, they probably not even provided proper shoes and jackets and torches and, you know, raincoats for the patrolling work. So how do we expect them to really do their day-to-day jobs? It's a very, very challenging situation that they are in. Forget their safety. I mean, the safety is absolutely not considered, because I don't think they are, you know, they get too much of a medical facility or insurances and all are covered. But they don't even have, you know, the equipments that they could probably protect themselves from an animal, or they could protect themselves from the rain, from the winters, the harsh winters that MP faces. They don't have jackets, they don't have raincoats. So today we all need to probably join hands, because without these foot patrol soldiers that we have, I mean, we call them soldiers, without these foot patrol soldiers, I don't think our forests are going to be protected. So we need to actually, as a country, join hands to do more for these soldiers, and also provide them with basic amenities, basic facilities where they could sleep safely, where they could live safely in the forest. Only then we can expect them to really protect the forest for all of us.
How can we help these rangers out?
Very simple, actually, Anish. There are, you know, the requirements are very, very basic. Like I mentioned, rain jackets during monsoon, winter jackets during winters, shoes for them for the patrolling. If we can give them hats, caps, we can give them some backpacks, water bottles, torches. These are the basic necessities that they need on a day-to-day basis to do their duty. I'm not even talking about their personal life. We're just talking about what they need to do for their duty. So these are the needs that they have. And again, if people are interested, students are interested to raise funds and provide with these jackets, we could give numbers to them. Each park officer, you know, at the ground level will be able to give a number saying how many jackets do we need? How many shoes do we need? It can be either locally sourced, or we could get them from your end or from anybody else who would like to sponsor. But these are some basic amenities that they ought to have for their day-to-day working.
Okay. Also, one of your key projects at LWF is your work with alternate livelihoods. Could you talk about some of your projects and why is it necessary to provide alternate livelihoods to help mitigate human-wildlife conflict?
So like I mentioned earlier, we're trying to work on human-wildlife conflict mitigation, Anish. Now, when we say mitigation, the reduction of dependency of people on the forest is what we are targeting, so that people don't need to enter the forest where they used to collect some leaves, tendu leaves, mahua flowers. So that's how they used to earn a living. But trying to avoid entering the forest would be the best way, so that there is no conflict situation inside the forest, at least. If we request them to avoid entering the forest, then we ought to provide them with an alternative. See, how will they earn an income? How will they earn a living? How will they feed their families? So which is why an alternate livelihood is the best source that we could find, living where they are. We're not even expecting them to migrate from into cities or migrate from the place where they're staying. But in the place where they are living, in the place where they're staying, with the limited resources available, if they could get an alternate livelihood, that would be the best option. With the Baigas, like I was mentioning in Kanha, there is a community known as the Baigas. Baigas are part of the PVTG, which is Particularly Vulnerable Tribal Group of Communities. And they have a beautiful skill that they make jewelry out of the beads, small beads, and they used to wear it for themselves. They used to make it for themselves. Over a period of last few years, we've managed to get this product as a product in the market where tourists can also buy the jewelry that they make. And the community is very happy doing it because they already knew how to do it. They are motivated enough to make the jewelry. While they make it for themselves, they make few extra ones that tourists can also buy. And with that, it's a good source of income where tourists can go and actually purchase this and avoid these baigas from entering the forest. So that is one. Second, we spoke about the nature guides training that we've given to the Pardis with the help of Taj Safaris. We partnered with Taj Safaris. And we've trained the Pardi members to become nature guides. And they're brilliant nature guides now where tourists can actually go on a walk with them. The activity is called Walk with the Pardis. At the same time, they're also trained to do camping with the Pardis. So there's a program called as Camping with the Pardis, where tourists can also go and camp with them overnight, listen to their stories over a bonfire, have some ethnic Pardi cuisine with them. And, you know, next morning, go on a walk and come back. So that is also available. Apart from that, village walks, cuisines in Panna, different community cuisines in Panna, Bandhavgarh, Kanha, all of these are already available. So we've created an experiential tourism product in all of these parks. We're also working in Kuno now. So Kuno has also been our newest destination where we started working. So Kuno also, we will soon be having the experiences that people can go apart from safaris, do activities with the community so that there are experiences that they can share with each other.
Okay. So my final question for you is, out of all these experiences and projects you've been working on, what has been your favorite experience working in the conservation sector?
So my favorite experience, I would say, is working with, of course, the Pardi community, because it was very, very fascinating for us to even understand the community first before we could work with them. So, you know, it's been a decade, but we still don't feel that, you know, it's been a long journey. We still feel that there's so much more to be done. So that's been one of my, you know, best experiences in the wildlife. But apart from that, I think the next best has been working with the Forest Department very closely. I think working with the department has given me so much of insight over what we call, you know, about conservation. That we could just join hands with the department and do so much more for our country. I feel there's been so many debates, so many discussions about, you know, what the department should be doing, the department should not be doing. But if we all just join hands and make sure we come in as a team, I think the department, Forest Department, will have so much more strength to do work on ground with simple things, like I mentioned, providing them with some clothing and jackets. So if we could just join hands, that would be the next best thing that I feel we could all do. And I've been struggling to do that. But I guess we are getting there. We are getting more help from different people. Tour operators, tourists have actually stepped up, stepped forward, and they've donated. They've actually provided help in kind, in cash. That has been helping us a lot. So that's another fascination that I have for providing support to the forest department.
Okay, so that's my final question. Thank you so much for your time. It was a lovely discussion with you today.
Thank you so much, Anish. It was lovely talking to you.